Hello again. It's great to have you back. Welcome to today's episode of the Bible Project Daily Podcast. And the project is to work together through the entire Bible, chapter by chapter, verse by verse. If you're here for the very first time, then why not click on that subscribe button and make the decision to join with the others who've decided to make the study of the Bible part of the rhythm of their daily lives. My name is Jeremy McCandless, and this podcast is hosted on thebibleproject.buzzsprout.com. And there you'll find links to lots of ways where you can access other free Bible teaching resources and even a transcript of everything I've said and links to all the other places and platforms where I put my teaching. So with that said, please do hang on at the end and I'll be able to update you about a few things and tell you the way you can do that or even partner with this ministry if you want. But other than that, we'll just drop back into the main text, looking at Matthew chapter 27, verses 11 to 26, and asking the question, what does it mean if Jesus really was innocent? In our judicial system, when a person is accused of a crime, that individual is considered innocent until proven guilty. However, if someone's accused of a crime, I think we usually suspect there must be some sort of evidence against them or they wouldn't have reached the point where they're being charged. We're probably inclined to think if there is an accusation, there's probably some basis for that accusation. Anyway, that's the way most people think generally, and they think at least it should be investigated and at some level a trial should take place to establish what actually happened. So when it comes to the person of Jesus, we know for a fact that he was tried. So perhaps way somewhere in the back of our minds, and certainly in the minds of some who don't describe themselves as Christians, they think, well, there must have been something going on for them to charge him with it. Now, I'm well aware that most people listening to this will theologically probably have reached a position where they believe that Jesus was the sinless Son of God. Now, I accept that and I understand that. But then this question and this mindset becomes troubling for us if we know we're meant to approach it with that perspective. If we know that he was the sinless Son of God from before the foundations of the world, yet he was destined to die, then how can we explain on a human level that Jesus was tried and convicted and actually suffered death and punishment for what he was accused of doing when yet we know he was the sinless Son of God? Now, I've had people that weren't believers say things to me along that lines and say, well, how can you say he was totally innocent? How was it then he was condemned? So I suppose, really, we've got to sort of delve into this and see what's going on here and what we're meant to learn from it. Is there any significance to us personally if we can answer those questions? Well, I believe there is, and we can. And with that, I'd like to invite your attention to Matthew chapter 27 today. Now, as you know, we've been going through the Gospel of Matthew for some time now, and we're fast approaching the end, and we've arrived at Jesus' trial before Pontius Pilate. Now, this is quite a long passage of scripture, and it can be divided into two parts. So we'll approach it in two chunks, if you like. It begins, first of all, with Pilate interrogating Jesus. After all, this is a trial, so to speak. And then later in the narrative, we see this interesting situation where another prisoner is released in his place. So the passage begins with a sort of interrogation, a trial of sorts. And then it moves into this incredible situation that has played out before us. So let's begin by looking at the interrogation of Jesus by Pilate, beginning in verse 11 through to 14, which tells us this. Meanwhile, Jesus stood before the governor, and the governor asked him, "Are you king of the Jews?" "You have said so," Jesus replied. Now, when he was accused by the chief priests and the elders, he gave no answer. And then Pilate asked him, "Don't you hear the testimony they're bringing against you?" But Jesus made no reply, not even to a single charge, to the great amazement of the governor. Now, just a little bit of background that might help you understand the context of what's happening here. As you've heard me say in previous studies, there were in fact six sort of quasi-trials of Jesus. The first three were Jewish, and the last three were done by the Roman authorities. He was arrested in the middle of the night, and he was taken to Annas, who was an ex-high priest, and then secondly he was taken to Caiaphas, the current high priest, and he was tried in a sort of Jewish court. But that happened at night when it should have happened during the daytime. So as soon as dawn comes, they now feel they have to have a trial in the daylight for it all to be considered legal. So they have the third of his Jewish trials. This time it's before the whole Sanhedrin. And then after that, they bounce him over to Pilate. Now you can only pick up all six of these trials by reading across all the gospel accounts and tying them together. But here he is standing before Pilate, and Matthew's telling us about this. And we know that Pilate, in a sense, didn't really want to have anything to do with this. And knowing that Jesus was actually a Galilean, he sent him to Herod Antipas, because that was the area of which Herod Antipas had authority over. Now, this guy is the one, you may remember, who had John the Baptist beheaded, and he had previously threatened to kill Jesus as well. But when Jesus actually stands before Herod Antipas, again, he doesn't open his mouth. So basically, Antipas sends him packing back to Pilate. So this is trial six, so to speak, the sixth time Jesus has stood before an accuser or the representative of the accusers. And in this case, we see Pilate beginning to interrogate him by simply saying, "Is it true what they're saying about it, that you say you are the king of the Jews?" Now, if you've been following along with us so far in just this Gospel of Matthew account, you'll know that at the previous Jewish trial before the Sanhedrin, they accused him of blasphemy, and that was indeed a capital offence worthy of death amongst the Jews. But that accusation had no significance among the Roman authorities. So they had to trump up another charge, and what they did was they accused him of pretending to be a king, taking what he said and twisting it and misrepresenting it. Now, from a Roman point of view, that was a problem and was potentially worthy of death, because it might be perceived as treason. So what's happening here is there are several charges and accusations being made against Jesus, and Pilate is picking up on the ones that are significant to him from his Roman authority point of view, which is why he asks very specifically, "Are you claiming to be the king of the Jews?" Now, in Matthew's account, Jesus is simply seen to say, "It is as you say." Now, as an aside, very quickly, there are people today who claim that Jesus is not the Messiah, and one of the reasons they try to use is that he never said he was the Messiah. It was something that he never claimed. So if you come across anybody who says that to you, you can take them to this verse in Matthew 27, where when asked, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus simply says, "Yes, you have just said it. I am the king of the Jews," he's saying, referring to the messianic title. Now, that's all Matthew records about this conversation, but John fills in a great deal more detail in John chapter 18, because John records for us that Jesus said, added on and said to this, "My kingdom is not of this world." And then John goes on to say that Pilate then asked him, "Well, are you a king?" And Jesus says, "You're right that I am a king, and that I was born for this cause, and I've come into the world that I might bear witness to the truth, and everyone who is of the truth will hear my voice." So in John's account, we're given a much more extensive and elaborate answer, not just this succinct answer recorded for us in Matthew. The point of the detail recorded in John is to show that Pilate was satisfied that this kingship that Jesus was claiming was not something that was politically dangerous to Rome. He was convinced that Jesus was not a revolutionary, or that he was in any way a dangerous usurper of Roman power. He wasn't even a political figure, and once he'd established that was not the case, he was satisfied. And that's why Pilate's interrogation begins with him just flat out asking him, "Are you the king?" And Jesus says, "Yes, but I'm not the kind of king you're thinking about, because my kingdom is not of this world." So Pilate, in a sense, then knew he had nothing to worry about. However, when it comes to the chief priests and the elders, there were other accusations, not actually recorded here in Matthew, but you will find them in Luke's account. Because they expand and tell us in Luke chapter 23 that he also said that he should not pay taxes to Caesar. But in fact, look at the original text, you see that Jesus, in a sense, said the exact opposite of that. Remember, he said, actually said, pay unto Caesar what is Caesar's. So they twist this and accuse him of suggesting that he and his followers should not be willing to pay taxes to Caesar. But again, when cross-examined by Pilate, he's convinced that no crime has been committed here, and certainly not one worthy of death. And yet here are the religious leaders clamouring and saying and making these false accusations. What I want you to notice in this is Matthew says he doesn't so much as open his mouth in some of these situations. In any situations where there's no proof against Jesus, Jesus actually felt that he didn't need to respond by saying anything. And in John's account, it very definitively tells us Pilate closes his cross-examination by saying, I find no fault in this man. So that's the first part of this passage. It's an interrogation, and at the end of the interrogation, the conclusion of the judge, so to speak, the arbiter in this case, Pilate, is that he, Jesus, is innocent of the charges presented. Now, I find it particularly interesting that Matthew points out for us that he didn't open his mouth, he didn't challenge a word when he was before the Sanhedrin. I wonder if you're thinking, if I was accused of something that I hadn't done, would you try and say something? Well, Jesus didn't when false accusations were made against him. He only spoke up when he was asked a direct question. And the question that Pilate asked him was, are you a king? Then he spoke up and said, yes, I'm a king, but I'm not the kind of king that you're thinking of. A couple of observations at this point. In the first place, I think it's worth pointing out that this is exactly what Isaiah prophesied about the Messiah in Isaiah 53, when it tells us he was opposed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. He was led as a lamb to the slaughter, and a sheep before his shearers is silent, and he opened not his mouth. Now, I think there's a spiritual principle here that we should pause and take note of. Just like Solomon said in the book of Ecclesiastes, there are times when we should be silent and there are times to speak. Sometimes you can give credibility to a lie by addressing it and trying, in a sense, to come up with an excuse or an opposition to it. You know, I wish when I was younger I'd maybe learned a while ago that there are times when I shouldn't have spoken up. And there are times, of course, when I wish, when I have said things, when I wish I could take the words back. Without going mad about this, this is an underused and underapplied bit of biblical wisdom. That is to know when to speak and basically when to keep quiet. And in this case, it seems Jesus said all he needed to say, and he felt no need for him to say anything else when faced with a false accusation. Remember when James said this in his pastoral letters, James actually told us from a pastoral point of view, he reminded us that we should be slow to speak. And Peter also in chapter 3, Peter says to a wife who has an unsaved husband that yes, they should give them the gospel, but if he doesn't respond, then if your witness is rebuffed and rejected, then Peter actually writes that really the perspective from that point on should be that you shouldn't irritate them. You can be silent about the detail, but just live a godly life before them. And that, of course, is talking about a situation where a wife converts and becomes a Christian and has a husband who isn't a believer at that point. In other words, you can leave it to others to explicitly explain the gospel, but after initially offering to do that, you yourself can just live the gospel. As someone once described it this way, it says, sometimes you yourself can't pick the fruit, but then don't bruise it with harsh words. Just leave it and let it ripen so that it may fall from the tree naturally. American theologian Haddon Robinson once wrote this, there are times when it is wise not to speak, where it is better to let your life say something before your words. So in other words, let the people hear the music before expecting them to sing the lyric. I think that's a nice way of putting it. Anyway, back to the main text, and the passage continues for us in verse 15. Now it was the governor's custom at the festival to release a prisoner chosen by the crowd. At that time they had a well-known prisoner whose name was Barabbas. So when the crowd had gathered, Pilate asked them, which one do you want me to release to you, Barabbas or Jesus, the one called Messiah? For he knew it was of self-interest that they should hand over Jesus to him. While Pilate was sitting on the judge's seat, his wife sent him a message, "Don't have anything to do with this innocent man, for I have suffered a great deal today in a dream because of him." But the chief priests and the elders persuaded the crowd to ask for Barabbas and to have Jesus executed. "Which of the two do you want me to release to you?" asked the governor. "Barabbas," they answered. "But what shall I do with Jesus then, who is called the Messiah?" And the crowd answered, "Crucify him." "Why?" Pilate asked. "What crime did he commit?" But they all shouted all the louder, "Crucify him, crucify him." When Pilate saw that he was getting nowhere, but instead the uproar was starting, he took water and he washed his hands in front of the crowd. "I am innocent of this man's blood," he said. "It is your responsibility." And all the people answered, "His blood is on us and on our children." Then he released Barabbas to them. But he had Jesus flogged and handed him over to be crucified. Now, the feast mentioned here, the beginning of this section, is the Passover. And part of what's going on here is that event is being celebrated. But what's going on behind the scenes in the back rooms is the crowd have been manipulated and motivated by the religious leaders, the Sanhedrin, those who want Jesus crucified, and they've been whipped up into a bit of a frenzy, so to speak. Pilate, as the text will tell us later, is in a bit of a dilemma, for he's afraid that this could become a full-blown riot. So he comes up, one might say, with a rather creative alternative. He says, "Okay, it's customary to release a prisoner as part of this festival celebration." And he goes and finds a prisoner, but he goes and chooses this guy, and he thinks that by choosing him, they're probably more likely to want to release Jesus. And he chooses a notorious guy called Barabbas. Now, the other gospel accounts fill in some details that aren't revealed here for us. For example, John tells us he was a robber, but Mark also says he was a murderer and an insurrectionist. Bible experts say, by the language used, that he'd murdered people from within his own Jewish community. So Pilate comes up with this rather incredible proposition and says, "Because it's customary for me to release one prisoner, here's this guy Barabbas I've chosen. He's the one convicted of robbery and murder. And on the other side you have Jesus, whom, by the way, I find no fault in. So who are you going to choose? Who should I release today?" But then further, you could say there's a bit of a newsflash here, a late breaking development, because a verse breaks in and tells us that during this time, actually, Pilate's wife contacts him and says she's had a dream, and she sends a note to him saying, "Don't have anything to do with the harming of this innocent man, Jesus." She realizes that her husband was potentially about to condemn an innocent man, and that was causing her some mental anguish. And she actually has a dream about it, or a vision, and she sends a note to him and says, "Don't have anything to do with this." Now, it is Pilate himself who we saw has already interrogated Jesus, and he's reached the conclusion that he's innocent, and his wife's dream, I'm sure, must have confirmed that. But the plot thickens, so to speak, and the chief priests and the elders, well, they've persuaded the multitude that they should in fact ask for Barabbas to be spared and that they should kill Jesus instead. And what follows in this passage is one of the most fascinating exchanges in the New Testament. He agrees to free Barabbas and he asks them then what should he do with Jesus, and the crowd shout, "Crucify him." But then Pilate says, "But what evil has he done?" Now let's just stop here for a second. If someone is on trial and the judge says, "I find no fault here, what evil has this guy done?" you would expect that they would come up with an answer. Maybe that someone would present evidence, some sort of proof that the accusation they were making against him was accurate. But look what actually happens. All they do is cry out all the more, saying, "Crucify him, crucify him." They don't even attempt to answer Pilate's question. They don't attempt to prove the accusation. They just keep repeating the call to crucify him. And by the way, isn't that a common technique when people often don't have an answer? They just keep repeating what they're saying or repeating the accusation that they're making. Have you ever had an argument with someone like that and you've tried to reason with them, but the person just wants to keep on repeating their point of view and ignoring what you say and not deal with the core issue? And as a matter of fact, we see by verse 24 that Pilate recognises he isn't going to win this argument, and rather this was becoming more and more of a clamour and potential of a full-blown riot. So he makes a decision and he stands before the crowd and he actually, literally, physically washes his hand before them and says, I am innocent of this man's blood, and if you want this, then its blood is upon your hands. And they shout back, yes, it's upon our hands, crucify him. So the Romans, they do what was asked of them. They set Barabbas free, and then they scourge Jesus, and they hand him over to be crucified. This idea of washing of the hands is a highly symbolic gesture to say, a way of saying, I want nothing to do with this. I am not the one who's found him guilty. In fact, I found him not guilty, and therefore, if this is going to happen, I'm not the one who's going to be guilty of his death. Now, there is a question that pops into my mind when I read this, and I'm sure into yours, which is why didn't Pilate do something? And I think the answer just reflects for us Pilate's character. One scholar I read said this: Pilate was warned by his sense of injustice, he was warned by his conscience, and he was even warned by the dream of a wife, but he could not stand up against the mob. Instead, he just made a futile gesture of washing his hands in a symbolic attempt to rid himself of the responsibility of what he knew was about to happen. The picture of Pilate this provokes in my mind is one of pity rather than loathing. Here is a man so enmeshed in his position that he's rendered helpless and afraid. He felt unable to take a stand for what he clearly knew at heart was right. In my mind, Pilate is a figure of pity and tragedy. He knew Jesus was innocent, but he still allowed him to be condemned to death because he was worried about his position of authority, and he was responding to the fact that these religious leaders were basically bent on having him crucified. As the political leader, he had the authority to overturn this, but he didn't have the will or the moral strength to do what he already knew was right. In the wider extended narrative that this passage sits within, we see three people one after another fail: Judas, then Peter, and now Pilate. Judas, we saw, succumb to greed and the devil himself. Peter succumbs to the flesh, and Pontius Pilate here succumbs to the world. He gave in to the mob. I think all of this can be summed up by simply saying this is showing us that Jesus was really innocent. But even so, even being innocent, he was still condemned, and he was condemned because of the hatred of the religious leaders and the weakness of the political system to protect those who were innocent from such things. I'd like to conclude by making a couple of observations. Number one, the core thing we must understand: Jesus was obviously genuinely innocent. The text demonstrates that. In fact, even Judas said he was innocent after he'd betrayed him, and Pilate, the one with the authority to make the final decision, also said he could find no fault in him. And even, as an aside, Pilate's wife said he was not guilty. The number one betrayer of Jesus and the number one judge who had the final authorities on these matters both recognized that Jesus was innocent. And the second observation I would make is that he was condemned ultimately because the religious and political leadership were in some sense jealous of him. They were jealous of his fame, of his miraculous power, of his spiritual perception, over the fact he maybe even had loyal followers. And this jealousy distilled into a hatred that led them to conclude that we've got to get rid of this man because he's a challenge to our position, our power, our prestige, and in Pilate's case, his authority. The whole narrative of this story exists to demonstrate to us that Jesus was condemned not because he was guilty. In fact, it was a rigged trial. That in fact he was condemned in spite of the fact that he was an innocent man. And that he was condemned, and note, a guilty one, was set free. Don't miss the big picture here. There was a man in this narrative who clearly was guilty, a man who was already condemned to death, but he was substituted and consequently went free, and the one who was not guilty went to death in his place. A guilty person went free because of the substitutory death of Christ. Does that sound familiar? Jesus was a substitute, and as a substitute, he paid the penalty for Barabbas, but he still pays the penalty for our sins today. As Isaiah wrote hundreds of years earlier, he was wounded for our transgressions. Jesus was an innocent man, and he died not because he was guilty, but because we are guilty, and this is one of the most significant and sacred spiritual truths in all of the texts of Scripture, and it's revealed for us fully here in this passage. He died in my place. Jesus took my sin. He bore the penalty of my sin so that I don't have to pay. As a matter of fact, it's even greater than that. Because I not only have my sins paid for, but I now go free. I am forgiven, and I get his righteousness in my place of my own righteousness. And that's something we can all have and share in. Paul writes elsewhere in the New Testament, "He who knew no sin became sin for us, for that we might be made the righteousness of God in him." This here, friends, is one of the most precious truths in all of the Bible, and our very eternal destiny hangs on how we respond to it. Jesus Christ paid, yes, but there's more than that. He sacrificed, and even more than that, he did it as a substitute. He did it in our place to pay for our sin. He did it for me in my place. He did it for you in your place. That's what it's telling us here. Our eternal destiny hangs in this, because when you understand that, when you understand that you are a sinner, and you understand that you are in need of this divine transaction, and that Jesus did indeed die and rise from the dead for you and in your place, and you trust in him and him alone, then you're given the gift of eternal life. And one of the most glorious illustrations of this fact is here in the story of the substitution of Barabbas. A rightly condemned, guilty criminal goes free, and Jesus dies in his place. So I wonder, do you today know that you've been set free? That you're set free if you trusted in Jesus Christ, and you're free from ever having to pay the penalty of sin, and you're free to go live in the light of that for the rest of your life. I think this story is one of the greatest illustrations in all of the Bible as what is called substitution, the substitutionary death of Jesus Christ for our sin. And it's always good to be reminded of this so that we can be grateful for what he did. So let me ask you a question. Based on this, if you know this to be true, what are you going to do with it for the rest of your life? You've been set free, but free to do what? What shall we do with our freedom? Well, according to the book of Galatians, Paul tells us the way to express our gratitude is really quite simple. It's to go and love one another. I'm sorry, did you think it was going to be more complicated than that? Well, my friend, that's the note on which I wish to end today. You've just got to love one another. If you've been set free, you have a license, you've been given your liberty, and you've been given a liberty to love. A license to love, if you like. Don't take it as a license to sin. Let me close by giving a quick illustration of how one might make this love of other people specific and practical. And do you know what? This wisdom comes from children. I used to work in social research myself for a little while, and I'm aware of a situation where a study was done and researchers asked children between the ages of 4 and 8, what does love mean? And I'd like to give you just some of the answers, and they turn out to be really simple, yet really profound. Tommy at 7 said, "When my grandmother got arthritis, she couldn't bend over and paint her toenails, so now my grandfather does it for her all the time. He still does it even though he's now got arthritis in his hands." Rebecca, age 8, said, "When someone loves you, the way they say your name is different, and you know your name is safe in their mouths." Kyle, age 5, says, "Love is when you give somebody some of your dinner without making them give you any of theirs." Christy, age 6, says, "Love is what makes you smile when you're tired or sad." Terry, age 8, says, "If you want to learn to love better, you should start with a friend whom you hate." Wow. And this came out of the mouth of a 6-year-old. "Love is like a little old lady and a little old man who are still friends, even after they've known each other so long that they really shouldn't be friends anymore." Another 5-year-old said, "Love is when your puppy licks your face, even when you've left them alone in the house all day." And Jessica, aged 8, says, "You really shouldn't say I love you unless you mean it. But if you mean it, you should say it a lot, because people forget that they are loved sometimes. My friend, I'm so grateful that Christ died for me and for you. And because of him, I've been set free. And because he loved me and did that for me, I'm going to tell everyone about how much he loves them too. Otherwise, they might simply forget what he did for them on a cross on a hill called Calvary 2,000 years ago. Okay, that's us for today. I do hope you find that helpful and encouraging and inspires you to go out and practically live out this message in your lives and in the lives of the people around you. My name is Jeremy McCandless and you've been listening to the Bible Project Daily Podcast. You can subscribe to it on whatever platform and wherever you get your podcasts from, but the podcast's actually hosted on the Bible Project at buzzsprout.com. And it is there you'll find the links to all the other ways you can connect with this ministry and receive and have access to the other resources that I make available. It's also the place where you can partner with this ministry if you want on places like Patreon, Buy Me a Coffee, etc. I do have plans in the next 6 months or so to launch a new podcast which will attempt to find an intersection with people who are not necessarily who want to sit down and study the Bible, that will look at the history and the great thinkers of the Christian church. I would love to be able to launch that podcast and use it as a way of reaching out into that huge category of podcast listening, which is history, and find a way in for people to come to know not only the Bible and how people's lives have been transformed by it for 2,000 years, but they may too personally might come to know the Saviour. So if you'd like to support me in that vision, then please visit me and connect with me on Patreon or one of the other platforms. Anyway, that'll do for today. Thank you so much for joining me. I do hope I'll see you here back again tomorrow. Well, it's always tomorrow for me, but whatever day happens to work for you, because you're completely free to just work along through this project, to go through the whole Bible, chapter by chapter, verse by verse, at whatever pace works for you and is comfortable for you. So I'll see you back here again soon. Bye-bye for now.